Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. Great to meet you.
Very great to meet you. I am so tickled to get to speak with you after watching Locked.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. Thank you.
You know, I'm no stranger to your work anyway. I love The Hive.
Oh, wow.
I love Nightbooks. I really adore
Thank
Brightburn.
you.
That's an interesting but an extremely visually stimulating film. So, and
I appreciate that. And you know what? I always love when people have seen Nightbooks, because I don't think Nightbooks, got the viewership, the adult viewership that I had hoped. But I love it, and it's kind of a deeply personal movie to me, and so it makes me feel good when I hear people saw it and enjoyed it.
it always upsets me when adults kind of dismiss films that they deem, YA or for kids, preteens or something, because some of the best storytelling in films is found in those movies.
I agree. I agree. Yeah, I mean, I kept, when I was, competing for the movie, I kept saying that E.T. is a, in many ways, a horror movie and one of the greatest movies of all time and a kids movie. And like, there's sequences in that movie that are that have defined how horror is shot in some ways. And it's E.T. So like, yeah, some of my favorite movies of all time are kids movies, so it was cool to make one.
Hey, well, let me tell you, the very first movie I ever saw when I was 4 years old was the original Nosferatu. It was my grandparents were from Germany. They loved it. My father loved it. So of course, in 1962, you must indoctrinate me into that world. So, and movies like Nightbooks, I've always gravitated towards them because of the potential that they have. And adults are missing out. But nobody better miss out on Locked. This was number one, it is horror to a very large degree and a lot of psychological terror. But there's actually great humor here, and parts of it are very, very fun. When I saw that it's all, he's locked in a car in an SUV for a few days and left in a parking lot being tormented. And first, I'm thinking, I immediately thought of Stephen Knight's film Lock with Tom Hardy, because 90% of that film. It's shot inside of a car with very unique camera movements. And of course, the character is driving the entire time. And we are just in the car. And I think Stephen had, I think he had told me, they had like 16 cameras, little GoPros all throughout the car to keep changing up the images.
Yeah,
And
is that how they shot that? I did not know that that's how they shot that. That's so
yeah,
cool.
they had cameras all over the car.
What's funny about that is I actually watched that movie a couple weeks before we started shooting Locked. I watched it going, okay, here's another creative who is locked in the same box that I am, for lack of a better term, and let's see how they handled it. And there's a lot of that movie that there are a lot of the shots in that movie are from like the hood through the windshield, through the from the side through the side window. And the struggle that we that one of the immediate challenges that this movie presented is because all of the windows on this car are tinted, I couldn't do anything like that. So my hands were even further tied. Like they were just, I was in a very literal box. It's tough because those shots were so beautiful in that movie. And the way the city lights and the headlights from other cars and the rear lights from other cars like would reflect across Tom Hardy's face, I thought was so beautiful. And I even for one moment considered breaking the rules of the movie because it was so beautiful. But I was like, I can't do it. I just can't do it. I had to keep that. I had to keep that. I don't know, consistent. So, yeah, it additional challenge we had to face.
Where you make up, where you change that, you couldn't do that and get the really cool lights through the windows and all, and the dash and all of that. You give us an SUV that is so tricked out and colorful inside. So whereas we're not getting color of light, city lights coming in through the windows on the outside, you have color and vibrancy inside this luxury SUV.
Yeah.
And you very smartly, it's a very luxurious SUV that has lots of room to crawl around, to change your camera up, front seat, back seat, driver's side, passenger side, constant movement of camera and of Bill in character as Eddie. So it keeps moving. Nothing stagnates. We always have something. And because of the color choice you have inside that SUV, your eyes have something to look at. It's not like you're driving at night and it's like, okay, it's dark and my head's nodding off. We don't get any of that.
Yeah. There's a trope, you know, and it's not 100% of the movies, but, you know, anytime you're dealing with, like, a contained thriller like this where it's, like, a guy or, you know, a person in a box, you know, someone in a cage, whatever it is, you know, the genre trope is almost that the cinematography will unfortunately be quite simplistic, and that's just because of the practical realities of filming in a tiny space are very difficult. You know, a lot of times the things you associate with, like, really cinematic visuals and stuff, those tools are taken from you because you're in such a tiny cage. So, like, for example, you know, I wanted to shoot this movie anamorphic, but typically anamorphic lenses won't even focus on things if they're closer to the lens than 6 feet to nine feet. You know, that's like the distance. But we were really fortunate because we were, like, you know, an indie movie, and we were able to start prep during the strike because we were not, you know, we are totally 100% an indie movie. You know, people that weren't, that would typically be working on giant movies weren't working. And so, you know, we went over to Dan Sasaki at Panavision, sorry, what's that?
No, I'm chuckling. I know. You go over there to Panavision, and when they don't have anybody else to support, you're going to get some help.
Yeah, he built us multiple lenses. So he designed, I told him what we wanted to do, what we were trying to achieve. I walked him through some things, and he, like, literally built us. He built us, like, I think the widest anamorphic they have over there. And then he built that one and blunt forced other anamorphic lenses so that we could focus almost to the glass, you know, that close of minimum distance. And then he had designed this thing for Chris Nolan, this lens with an elbow joint, you know, so we could, you know, shoot around corners and stuff like that. He designed it for, Dunkirk, but they went a different way, so he never got to build it. So he's like, I want to try to build it for you guys. So he built that for us. He built us a bunch of really amazing things, a probe lens, like I think the only anamorphic probe lens in the world. So you know, we came at it with this very, like, okay, we're trapped in this box. Let's break this trope. Let's make something incredibly cinematic in this tiny little space that we have, and be a feast for the eyes, you know, and keep it exciting.
You definitely do that. There is something new to look at with every frame in this film, David, and it keeps the energy flowing. You know, the editing, it gives you a lot to work with. People might not realize that, but because of the constant movement in the car, and then you get your interstitial cutaways as days and nights are passing, sitting there in the empty parking lot, which, it's amazing. Nobody even notices this vehicle has been sitting there for 5 days or whatever.
True. I was fortunate enough to have, you know, Bill giving this incredible performance and being so unbelievably captivating through that whole thing. You know, so much of your experience watching it is through his lens, through his sort of experience, and he's so grounded and real and charming. So, despite being this sort of, you know, anti-hero in a way.
Yeah.
This, you know, low-level criminal, like, you still can't help but root for the guy. He's so unbelievably likable, you know?
Yeah, and because of the fact that he keeps yelling, you know, I gotta pick my daughter up from school. I gotta pick my daughter up, you know? So he's a father who wants to do good, and he loves his daughter. But mm-hmm. he just doesn't quite know how to be a good dad. And this is where the beauty of casting Anthony Hopkins is. Oh my God, David, you have given us Hannibal Lecter 2.0. The venom, the malevolent glee that William has, it was so Hannibal Lecter.
When I sat down for breakfast with him for the first time after he read the script and we were going to talk about the role, we immediately identified about each other that we really enjoyed dark characters mm-hmm. and exploring that darkness in people. And we were both like, uh-oh, this is going to get, like, we're going to, because we were immediately, like, pushing the character darker and into, like, more intense places. And, I think between the two of us, you know, it's great to hear that connected with you in that way.
Oh, my God. And because Anthony has such a, he can do almost anything with his voice in terms of cadence and rhythm. So we're getting that from Silence of the Lambs as he's taunting Clarice about, can you hear the lambs screaming now? Can you hear the lambs screaming now? And the rapidity with which he says it. The rapidity and the repetition. And we're getting that here as well. Not only through the phone, the built-in phone, but also when we see at night and the window goes down just 1 inch, maybe 1.5 inches, and you see that one eye. And then slowly, it's not a full face. We get one eye initially for a half profile. And then Michael and his camera operator just tilt it ever so slightly so we get a little more, but constantly shrouded in darkness.
Yeah. There's a piece of that shot that everyone misses. There's a piece of that shot that everyone misses that is one of my favorite pieces of that shot, and it's the thickness of the glass that of the window that's lowered. You know, it's like, you know, truly armored glass, like, you know, it's so thick. we went through painstaking details to make everything as real, you know, as it would be, as realistic as possible. And I love that detail, like, lives there and that, you know, and that people don't see it immediately.
I saw how thick it was.
Yeah.
As his face starts turning and the light, and this is a beautiful shot, with a street light. And it's slightly bouncing off of part of his face. So you're really playing with negative space and shadow.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Oh, that's so cool.
Which makes William even creepier. But you can see at that point, you can see the thickness there. And had anybody been putting their hands on the glass and wrapping their knuckles around it or fingers around it, it would have been more obvious.
Yeah.
But so I like what you've done with that.
Thank you.
This SUV is a character. It is a main character. It's not just a two-hander here. This is a three-hander. And the SUV is a character. So I've got to ask you, did you have this custom made? Obviously, a lot of it with gun bullets and things and wrecking and all of that. And the interior, sure you can get it off a lot or something. But because you needed the thicker windows, because you needed the windows totally, essentially one-way blackout, How did you go about procuring or creating the SUV?
That's a great question. We had essentially one set for most of this movie, right? And so I spent a lot of money on just that one set, making it like the perfect thing for this movie. And the funny thing is that the start of this movie, I wasn't really a car person. Like, I have friends who are car people. They talk about cars and stuff. I didn't really know much about cars. But through the process of prep for this movie, did very deep dives on, I feel like I know way more about cars than I ever need to now. But what we ended up doing was, this legendary guy in like car movie, like movie car space. Like he built the Batmobile for Chris Nolan, and just unbelievable guy. And Grant Armstrong, who was he was art director on Gravity, but we brought him on as our production designer because when I met with him, he told us on Gravity that like they had to shoot in these small pods, and the way they would do it is they built a set on a platform on rails,
mm-hmm.
and they would just slide pieces of the set out, and really simply. And so we started talking about doing something like that, and that could give us a lot of opportunities. So between Andy, who like you know builds these incredible Batmobiles,
yeah.
and stuff, and Grant, who's this like unbelievable artist and designer. We had this like dream team that came together and made this car, and the goal was to make something, you know, the goal the whole time was to just be as authentic as possible and try to explore if this were to really happen, how would it play out? And so we tried to tie our hands, as much as possible by the technology that's available today,
mm-hmm.
like real metal and glass supply, like, you know, really hold our hand to the fire and try to make something authentic. So we ended up having three cars. There's a stunt car,
mm-hmm.
kind of exterior, you know, the exterior of the car, it looks right, but the inside is like roll cage and stuff, like protective stuff for the stunt driver.
Yes.
Then we had what we called the hero car, which was the exterior and interior were like great, could drive and everything. And that was the one that we shot with in that parking lot because I wanted to do everything I could as real as possible. And then the third one was the one that was on the soundstage that mm-hmm. could break apart in those rails.
I love the Batmobile reference. I mean, I actually knew the the creator of the original Batmobile, George Barris.
Whoa.
I knew him for many years. And many of those cars that he built from the ground up.
Yeah.
And, of course, that mantle had to get handed off as technology changed and to newer people. So I know that you were in very good hands with having this SUV constructed and,
yeah.
you know, customizing that interior the way it is. Did you use real leather in there?
I believe it's real. Yeah, I think it's real leather. I think they had to, so they, I don't remember. There was a situation where there was leather in Italy that we wanted to get. I don't remember if we ended up getting that leather or not, but it's real leather, and it's real leather, and the piping on the edges and some of the stitching is copper wire.
Mm-hmm.
So that you know when Anthony Hopkins' character, when William is tasing him, that you could understand the mechanics of how that's working. You know?
Yes.
So it's all, so there's nowhere he could be in the car where he couldn't be tased.
It looks so supple. That's why I had to ask.
Cool.
Because yeah, basic vinyl covering or something, or even like a faux leather, is not going to have that supple movement as poor Eddie is climbing over seats and digging his elbows in or his chin in.
Yeah.
So every detail is just so perfect. And of course,
Thank you.
We finally get, when we get William in the car, and he joins Eddie, his poor little hostage, and we're driving around. Those night shoots are gorgeous. And I love the fact that you have this set in a very rainy period and we get a lot of rain, because nothing looks as good as cars traveling on a soaking wet pavement.
That's right. Yeah.
In the dark.
Yeah. Seven was a constant reference and conversation for the city, you know, because we shot in Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
but this is so, but you know, we wanted it to be a North American city, you know, probably a West Coast North American city, but something that was, you know, gloomy and grimy, but it could be anywhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that rain, so, by the way, so much of that was real, was brutal for us to shoot in, but man, it's exactly like you're saying. There's nothing that looks like that. It just creates so much atmosphere, and I don't know, it totally felt like the movie.
And even the way real rain beads on your windows and the way it hits it, it does stuff that rainbirds can't do.
Yes.
So yes. I knew real rain had to be in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah, lots of it. But we did have to, have some towers.
Yes.
And yeah.
Of course, you have a climactic single car chase scene, I'll call it, this is where you're editing. As good as the editing is showcasing Eddie's claustrophobia and frustration inside this SUV for days, the editing of this single car chase scene is superb as we cut back and forth between inside the vehicle and outside as things are speeding along. And really well done at maintaining pace and interest, because we don't want to lose what's happening inside the car. Yeah. By this point, you have us so hooked, or you had me so hooked, I didn't want to miss a single bit of dialogue. I didn't want to miss a single anything that was going on inside that SUV.
I'm so happy to hear that, and I'm so happy that you made reference to the editor, because so many times we have these interviews and people are like, wow, cinematography, Bill, Tony, amazing. But I had a team of editors, a guy named Andrew Buckland, incredible editor, and then the editor that I've worked with on Brightburn, Nightbooks, and now this, Peter Gavazdez, and they were just an unbelievable team. And they constructed this thing, and Andrew's understanding of character, and Peter's ability to like carve out that action and make it feel so tense and visceral. Like, I mean, they were just a dream team.
And that's a key word, tense, because this is, you are on tenterhooks for so much of this film. And you give us some real cringeworthy moments, too, such as Eddie. He's like dying of thirst. He hasn't had anything to drink. Of course, he was a little wimpy about it, about he's only gone 24 hours and didn't have water. Everybody knows it takes longer than that to die from not having water. But the entire pee into a small 20-ounce empty water bottle or soda bottle, and then cap it off, and then a day later or something goes to try and drink it. Okay, that was a gag me moment as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the thing. Like, I am just personally a sucker for like that part of the human experience.
Yeah.
The part that people don't like to talk about, the things that we all know but don't say to each other, that scene, filming it made me laugh, watching it with an audience makes me laugh. It's just a literal bundle of joy for me.
It's so funny, but it's still, it's like a gag me moment. But it's funny, and you see what Bill does with his facial expressions and cringing and holding his nose.
I could tell you something funny about that scene.
Oh, please do.
So I came to Bill and I said, I'm chasing authenticity in this movie. I'm trying to do everything as real as possible. And I have a pet peeve about, in movies, people retch and gag, and you see that someone gets grossed out by something. But, like, when you actually do that, there's all these involuntary muscles that, your face changes, your eyes walk. Like, it's just a different thing than when you pretend. It just is. And you can identify it. It's just not as effective. It's not as believable.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, on TikTok, there's this trend going around where there's this Swedish fish, this can of Swedish fish, that if you open it, it smells so bad that people start retching and throwing up from just the smell. And so we filled up the bottle of piss with that Swedish fish. And so when he opened up the bottle, he said that the entire interior of the car just filled with the most vile
smell
he's ever smelled in his entire life. And that's why that sequence is, I think, so believable and so stand out and so, like, effective.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that would do it. You know, for me, it would be if you had the scent of boiling cauliflower, which is almost as bad. But how challenging was the edit process working with Andrew and Peter to find the pace of this film? Because while we have so much happening within the SUV, there are moments of quiet, moments where poor Eddie is curled up on the seat like a little kid in a fetal position trying to sleep. And then the action, and then the energy that comes when William calls him and Eddie gets defiant and it gets a little faster. It's like the heartbeat starts racing.
I mean, editing a movie is always challenging, right?
Yep. Because
your objectivity is fleeting. You know, it's the most precious resource, and every time you watch it, every time you rewatch the scene, you lose a little piece of it. You know, and so that's a challenging piece. And also, you know, I could always do more. Like, no matter what, I could always do more. Like, I just recently rewatched Brightburn for the first time since it came out, because I had some friends who had never seen it. They wanted me to watch it with them. And I'm watching it, and I'm writing down, in my head, I'm like, oh, I could cut here. I wish I could do this, you know? there's always cutting I could do. There's always re-shifting around I could do. So it's always a challenge, and it's always a challenge to put your pencils down on a movie. But this one was unique because it's so character driven, and the challenge is, how do we keep this conversation? This conversation's a set piece. It's an action set piece.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and how do we cut it so it feels like an action set piece? How do we? And I did that. I to be totally honest, that thread started in Nightbooks. The turn to Act Two in Nightbooks is a sequence where Alex he needs to read a story or the witch will kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're talking about like the first major action set piece or whatever in a kid's movie, and it's a conversation. It's like a 7-minute conversation, and that's a dangerous swing to take, but I just believe that we could pull it off. And number two, that, you know, how do we treat that like life and death stakes the whole time? This is like my favorite interview. I'm so sorry to have to wrap up because I hope every time I make a movie we do this again.
Oh, please. I hope so, David. And unfortunately, I didn't get to ask you about the score, about Tim's wonderful score. And
okay,
how?
Ask me about the score. I want to do that before I go.
Tell me about the score. I'm not going to ask you. Tell me about the score, David.
Okay. So I had just met with Anthony Hopkins. I'm like, he's doing the movie. Like I flew from Breakfast with Him back to New York. I landed, went to Brooklyn, and I'm walking around Brooklyn. And my mind is just on this movie, like finding the tone, finding everything, finding what this movie's going to be. And there's a percussionist, like a street drummer, playing like down the street, and I hear it echoing off the walls and echoing off the graffiti alleyway that's mm-hmm. in front of me and stuff. And I was like, that is the sound of his world. Like, that is it. You know, I went around the corner and saw the guy, and he was like playing on paint buckets and pans and stuff and just beating them with sticks, and he was making this very like tribal, like primal sounding music, but there was an urban, city feel to it as well. And I was like, that is the soundscape. So working with Tim again, I mean, he did an amazing job on Brightburn, but getting to work with him again, I told him, it's percussion only. It's percussion only. And so like 95% of the score is pure percussion. He found a lot of creative ways to make sounds with only percussive things, like hitting. I think he hit a cello as a percussive instrument at times, but it was just pure percussion. And a lot of times we would echo it into like city spaces, so it's still you could feel that sense still of my walk through Brooklyn that one day.
And there it is, percussion. There it is, the heartbeat that I mentioned to you. We feel the heartbeat.
Yeah. Yes.
David,
yeah, that's so cool.
Brilliant. I love
Thank
this
you.
Film. I'm going to watch it again. I'll watch this one numerous times, I guarantee you.
That's amazing.
And yes, I hope we get to chat again in the future. This has been fantastic.
I agree. Me too. Me too. Please. I look forward. I got to go make another movie so we can do this again.
That's it. So get to work.
All right. I'll talk to you later.